Hello, and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan, coming to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show,
the most recent idea of mass tourism and the modern tourism is the fact that there's exploitation by big multinational corporations.
Protests across Europe against over-tourism are gaining momentum as the cost of living in the continent continues to increase. Also,
I didn't have to tell my girls or my kids about it. They saw it on social media. She started to ask, how are they going to control it? Are they going to come to our house to check on us?
The deadline for the government's under-16 social media ban is rapidly approaching. And what's not clear is how it will be enforced. And later today,
To move forward, it would be good for the Liberals to look at their history and to look at, their different approach to politics.
New research traces the Liberal Party's so-called women problem back to the former Howard government. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, as the NDIS struggles to sustain demand, the government has turned its attention to foundational supports, a tier of community-based supports outside of the scheme. Last Wednesday saw Minister for Disability Mark Butler announce the $2 billion Thriving Kids program, shifting towards that tier while cutting some from the NDIS, a move which has proved controversial amongst advocates and the disability community. The Wire's Sam Giorgio spoke with CEO of Autism Awareness Australia, Nicole Rogerson, to find out more about the program.
In short, we're not sure yet. I think the minister's made this announcement that this program of Thriving Children is about looking at the kind of existing services that belong in the States and how we can upskill them and help them to support children with learning developments and mild autism. It's a very bold move for the government to have a rethink about developmental pediatrics. We're going to have to wait and see what ends up getting delivered.
The program is said to provide much needed support for children with developmental delay and autism. However, there are fears that the rollout time could potentially leave thousands of families without essential NDIS services. How has your community responded to this news?
I think it's fair to say everybody's very nervous, but the minister has said, you know, they're not throwing people off the NDIS tomorrow. There's no reason for alarm. I know people are going to be nervous, but I don't think they need to be. I think the minister was quite clear on that point.
Children and Young People with Disability Australia have made recommendations for the government, like a longer rollout time for the Thriving Kids program, a pause on NDIS reassessments, and a clear path that supports children with disabilities over 9. What else can be done to support the program and people with disabilities?
What the government really need to do is work quite closely with experts in the field of child development to make sure what we build, which is going to be in place of eventually the NDIS for some children, we want to make sure we get that right. It's a really great opportunity. We've never done that in Australia. We check babies to see that they can hear and that they can see, but we don't do those developmental checks, those social and emotional checks. And the fact the government's talking about doing that with three-year-olds and then seeing what they need, this is a really good opportunity, but you've got to get that right. We need to work with experts to make sure what we end up designing is actually going to support those children the way they need support. If you're going to make a big change and the NDIS isn't all of a sudden the only port in the storm, then you've got to make sure that the alternative is doing the job that you need it to do. And then I think you'll see that families feel a lot more relaxed.
Do you believe it's too early to tell if the program will provide enough support for those with disabilities and autism?
Yeah, I think it's way too early to tell. The thing hasn't even been properly designed. It's a thought. I think the government has arrived with a big stick and $2 billion, which is not an insignificant amount of money to say, let's get this right. I'm all for judging governments when they do things wrong. But at this point in time, we don't know enough to really judge it. And I think people being really nervous about their situation changing, I think people should also be equally nervous that if we don't fix the NDIS and get it set up in a much better position to be more stable and sustainable, we'll lose it altogether. I think we've just got to be rational about what we're worried about. And I, for one, are very much willing to work with the government to make sure they get this right.
In his speech yesterday at the National Press Club, NDIS Minister Mark Butler said that the NDIS needs to return its focus on people who need significant permanent care and support and ensuring it remains fiscally sustainable. What's your reaction to this quote?
I think it's true. I think that the problem has been is for some people, the access to the NDIS has become very broad. In some cases, children only need a developmental delay in one area to give them an NDIS package that they may not need. That sort of individual funding going to families to work out how to spend it in an open, already busy market, there's a chance we were spending a lot of money on the NDIS, but maybe we weren't spending it smartly. I think it's fair to look at that. But it's also, I think, a recognition that the minister's saying for those with moderate to profound disabilities, the NDIS, that was designed for those people. That's not going away. It's merely thinking about, have we put too many people in the scheme that possibly could be helped elsewhere? Just think where possible. I'm just trying to make sure parents aren't panicked. I know they're going to be. And there's a few interesting people making commentary that is potentially inflaming the situation. We literally don't know enough yet. This has just been announced yesterday. It's a recognition we need to restructure the NDIS and do it differently.
CEO of Autism Awareness Australia, Nicole Rogerson there, speaking with The Wire's Sam Giorgio.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Protests across Europe against over-tourism are gaining momentum as the cost of living in the continent continues to increase. Spain will host an estimated 100 million international travellers this year, and local residents in Barcelona are protesting, saying mass tourism increases their cost of living. The Wire's contributor from Tune FM, Ash Taylor, spoke with senior lecturer in tourism management at the University of South Australia, Dr. Freya Higgins Debiol, about the impacts of mass tourism.
Well, one of the big impacts is about the economics of tourism. The states, governments, communities engage with tourism, not to host tourists for the fun of it, but it is about jobs, foreign exchange, income, infrastructure. So one of the critical questions that come is, does tourism actually deliver those benefits? And then how do those benefits trickle down through the economy into the community's pockets? And I think the most recent idea of mass tourism and the modern tourism is the fact that there's exploitation by big multinational corporations who are bringing in tourists to destinations and extracting wealth and extracting the opportunities and impacting on the infrastructure while leaving very little benefits behind. And perhaps the iconic image of that are the cruise ships. The cruise ship industry is very consolidated under three multinational corporations. And the model of the cruise ship is to keep all wealth within the corporate structure as much as possible. But you get the same thing also with the cheap airlines.
It is such a complicated topic that I've certainly never thought too deep into it myself. A lot of things to think about, and I'm really interested in what you said about how it changes the essence of a place, and this is something that you say you have personal experience with. What does that mean to change the essence of a place from tourism?
It's a really complicated phenomenon, and some of my colleagues specialize on some of these issues. It can be both for good and for bad. So, changing the essence of the place might be bringing in services and infrastructure and diverse experiences that the local people can benefit from. So, for instance, on my home island, we were poor when I was a youth. That's quite a long time ago, but it was a poor place. And the tourists coming in and bringing money into the economy gave government coffers for infrastructural development. So when I was a teenager, we actually liked the tourists because they brought outsiders, they brought excitement, they brought young people to date and, increased our interactions with outside people. But at the same time, then it changed the culture with outside cultures coming in. And even with this just being wealthier people from the rest of the United States coming to this island off North Carolina, it did change some things in a negative way, but also, for instance, it helped reduce the racism because it was a racist place as well. But the question, I think, becomes, how does the community feel about the changes that are being made, and how are they listened to, and how can they be engaged in influencing the decisions that are happening?
I guess it all comes down to this concept of sustainable and responsible tourism. I guess, you know, we've sort of given a few examples, but responsible or sustainable tourism versus irresponsible tourism, where's the line?
Well, responsible tourism is focused upon the idea that the tourist consumer has capacity to influence the way tourism occurs. So agencies, bodies will give education. So that's what responsible tourism does, is tries to do tourism education, to gear tourists to creating positive impacts in the places that they visit and reducing their negative impacts. Sustainable tourism looks at the idea of the tourism system and it asks, how can you manage tourism so that it becomes in balance, not imbalanced. So it's in balance with the idea that you access the assets of tourism in a community, but it becomes maintainable into the future. The difficulty with that definition, though, is it's very tourism-centric. So it doesn't ask what's happening in the wider economy, ecology, society that might be undermined by tourism.
What are some of those practices that could lead to a shift in how we look at the tourism industry?
Really wonderful question. And I think the first step is just to educate yourself. I know, you know, it's kind of anathema to holidays and getting away from it all with this idea that you've got to educate yourself about the place you're going. But you should. You should learn something, know something. What are the pain points the community faces? Are there water issues? Are they in drought? Do they struggle like for Bali?
Dr. Freya Higgins-Debiol from the University of South Australia there, speaking with Tune FM's Ash Taylor. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Armidale on 2ARM, to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC, and to the other side of the country on Radio Galari in Broome, Western Australia. A ban on social media apps for children under the age of 16 is just months away from introduction. Whilst the government's December deadline rapidly approaches, what's not clear is how it will be enforced. Rosh V is the host of the Busy Mums radio show on Alive 90.5 FM, and she brought together three mothers, Sabrina, Leslie and Vivian, to hear their thoughts.
My boy is actually not so much on social media. He plays games most of the time. But to be really honest, my 12 years old actually started social media at a pretty young age. I think the ban is actually a big move. The ban is only a band-aid. School bullying not only started when social media started. We have to monitor all these activities, especially at this young age. My kids use social media, but I always monitor what they're using. So I teach them about resiliency.
Thanks, Vivian.
Yeah.
Sabrina, over to you.
I agree with the ban. I think it's a good thing. I've got a 15-year-old daughter. I've got a 13-year-old son. Similar to Vivian, my son is more on gaming, doesn't really engage with social media apps. My daughter, she became very accustomed to using those social media platforms. We've noticed over time she's become more and more dependent on social media as her way of communicating with her peers. What really hit hard for my husband and I was we thought our daughter was studying. It was midterm exams. She's in year 10. We discovered after her exams she did poorly and had clocked up to 59 hours in that week when she was supposed to be studying using social media. So she was in her room, door closed. We respected her privacy to study. But unfortunately, she got easily distracted. I think they are distracting tools. Like, studying's too hard. I'm just going to go and log in and see what my friends are talking about. She'd kill me if she knew I was saying this on live radio. We've had to set strict boundaries because we trusted too much. And I think that's a mistake as a parent. We think that they're smart enough, they're mature enough, but their brains haven't fully developed. Mm. There's still a lot that they have to learn. And they turn to social media as the answering point. It's the talking point for everything. What makeup, perfumes, clothes, brands, they just become so dependent on it. And so my viewpoint is I agree with ban because I think that we need to protect young minds.
I'm sorry to hear that, but thank you for that opinion. Leslie, what's your opinion?
I'm kind of on the fence with it, but I'm not on the fence. The thing that I said to my daughter when she was younger, she got bullied at school. She's 27 now. She'd kill me too if she found out. people look at you in a different format while you're on social media. So for all those girls that take their photos in their bra in the bathroom, I said to my daughter, if I ever catch you, if I ever find one photo like that, watch out, I'm chasing you down, because that is just so wrong. They're actually exploiting themselves because they don't understand the consequences behind it. I don't believe that it's good for children. So I said to my daughter, when you can control what happens at school, then you can use social media. It's not just children, but it's adults doing it to other adults. On, you know, I heard of one of my friend's defamation, her ex-boyfriend, and now he's suing her. I mean, she was bullying him online and she's a 57-year-old woman. Come on, you know? So it all comes down to the parents to do their thing.
Vivian, what do you think about the old-fashioned play dates?
My kids still do that sometimes, but rarely nowadays.
Sabrina, are you still having the play dates?
No, and I miss them terribly. I used to be part of a mother's group, so we used to meet weekly, and it was so good to connect. Now it's connecting online. My son doesn't want to leave the house. He'd rather game.
Why not ban the gaming then?
That's the thing. The video games are not under the ban.
But when you think of video games is murdering, killing and shooting. That's right.
Yeah, and the harass words can happening on games like Roblox as well.
Exactly. I know. Kicked off. My youngest son is addicted to games. He doesn't have any social media platform. Mm. So I think it is harmful.
But it's the parents that allow them to do it. So the parents must put boundaries around what you allow your child to do.
Yeah. My son's high school principal strongly stressed that no gadget in bedroom. So I don't allow any gadgets in bedroom.
Good on you, yeah.
Excellent. Okay, this ban is coming. Have you talked to your children about it? What have you implemented? What's in place now for this lead up to this law?
Like I say, I didn't have to tell my girls or my kids about it. They saw it on social media. She started to ask, how are they going to control it? Are they going to come to our house to check on us?
No, they're going to control it through their digital ID.
That's right.
And this is where it's all going about control. It's not just about the privacy. It's about the digital ID. They're doing it so that they can control the children now so that they don't learn the history that we know.
They're still testing the age recognition technology. Apparently a 30-year-old has been recognized as a child and her account was banned. So the other way could happen, where a young person could be authorized.
Biometrics or something.
So they're still working on that.
Mm-hmm. My daughter is going to have a rude shock December the 10th, not being able to use Snapchat, not being able to use Instagram.
You just got to ask, what's the real reason behind it? Because they don't care about the kids, I can tell you that now.
The government, no.
100%.
Let's be honest about that.
The kids go around this?
Of course they will. Their kids are smarter than the adults.
Working
what about
on it,
the age assurance technology? Do you have concerns about
what's
privacy?
What's the age assurance?
That's the technology they're using.
That's what I'm saying. So wrong on so many levels. It's a new world order. I'm sorry.
Yes, I agree with you. Mm.
That's where we're going to, and I'm not
it's
looking forward
for,
to it.
For control.
100%. 100% communist country coming in.
It'll be interesting to see how things pan out. But
So, Leslie, you're on both, for and against?
Well, kind of. I'm more in horror that the government are doing for the control part.
Sabrina, you're for the ban?
For the ban.
That was Alive FM's Rosh V with that story. For this and more about the ban, you can find From Pillar to Post wherever you get your podcasts.
Different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
New research from Monash University traces the Liberal Party's so-called women problem back to cultural and policy shifts under former Prime Minister John Howard. Research author Dr. Blair Williams says the party, once the political home of many women voters, abandoned its socially liberal traditions in the 1980s and has since struggled to win them back.
The Liberal Party started out, I mean, they
you know, help formed really by some leading conservative feminists at the time in the 1940s. And, you know, they were a party that women predominantly voted for, and they actually ran on women's issues in the 40s and 50s at, you know, several elections, which sounds quite different to what we're seeing in recent elections. And so I wanted to really trace that shift to understand what happened and when and why. And how the Liberal Party can get back to, I guess, being more friendly for women, both in terms of women in the party as well as women voters and women's issues.
Where does the shift begin, or what can we trace it back to?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, the Liberals and the Conservative Party generally, because the Liberals, again, formed in 1944. Prior to that, there were various Conservative parties, and they, since the 20s, have always really formed a coalition with the Nationals or Country Party, whatever it was called back in the day. And so I can't imagine that would be a huge, I mean, obviously it's an influence on you know, the Liberal Party, but at the same time, they still managed to be more women-friendly from the 40s to the 70s than they have since. So I would really identify the shift in this to the 1980s, or the late 70s to the 1980s, where the neoliberal turn happened in the party. So more people in the party, particularly John Howard, when he was still treasurer in the Fraser government, began adopting more neoliberal approaches to politics and especially policy. And neoliberalism is very much not friendly to women's issues because it sees the role of the state as not being big, as not being, you know, I guess we're social liberals, which is what the Liberal Party used to be. Their view of the state is that it should help, you know, encourage equality of opportunity, where neoliberalism sees the role of the state as not that. It should be a small state, and that very much harms women's issues and women generally. But you also saw a bigger rise as well in the social conservatism of the party and the influence of the so-called new right of the US kind of trickling down into Australia and influencing the way that the Liberal Party saw women in the electorate.
And how have Liberal Party leaders since Howard upheld these ideals or kind of furthered them?
Yeah, so John Howard really cast a long shadow. Like, the Liberal Party really is defined by two giant leaders, right? You have Robert Menzies, who co-founded the party and very much influenced the first few decades of the party and still has some kind of influence in the party, obviously, as well. And you have John Howard, who really reshaped the party in his image and also reshaped what it means and what it looks like to be a Liberal leader in his image. And recent or subsequent leaders like Tony Abbott, Peter Dutton, Scott Morrison have really channeled Howard in numerous ways, both in their, you know, political leadership masculinity and what that looks like, as well as their approach to, for example, gender equality policy, which really draws on that more socially conservative and neoliberal approach, which encourages, you know, the so-called choice for women, and as well as, you know, those more traditional gender norms and gender roles as well. And so that's been a really identifiable shift and something that has continued since Howard's era of the 80s and 90s. I mean, it sounds a bit odd, right? But to move forward, it would be good for the Liberals to look at their history and to look at, you know, their different approach to politics in its first, say, 3 or 4 decades. And that was very much that would be very much a return to social liberalism, which is an approach, you know, to politics and government that really sees a role, you know, the state having a role in ensuring equality of opportunity, in you know, ameliorating, I guess, the excesses of capitalism on people in the electorate, and to push, you know, women's rights both in the workplace and in other areas as well. And so that would be, I think, a beneficial thing for the Liberal Party. And we've seen, you know, in the last few elections that this move to the right has not really worked for them in terms of both voters. Women have been moving away even more from voting for the Liberal Party than they have in recent decades. And it also is not exactly great for the party itself because, you know, the policies that they push forward also don't exactly encourage women in the party and you know, they're having problems both trying to pre-select women as well as just the number of women that they have in the party generally.
Lecturer in Australian politics at Monash University, Dr. Blair Williams, ending that report. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire has been produced today with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries on which this program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan. As always, thank you so much for your company. And we'll see you next time on The Wire.